as the Hagia Sophia, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, last night, which was about as half as far as I wanted to get. That's always the problem. When I start on things that I like, I tend to come down with diarrhea of the mouth, and I say more than I really think you need to know, or even that you'd be interested in knowing, but it's what I like, so the heck with you. There are a couple things that I think would be of interest to you as far as Byzantium is concerned, though, and so I don't want to leave Byzantium with the Hagia Sophia. Byzantium is one of these incredible times in history. When you stop to think that it starts around the middle of the 300s, and at the end, the last emperor of Byzantium is a guy named John Palaiologos. And Palaiologos is in such trouble with the kingdom because of these invading tribes knocking on his northern door that he goes over to Rome and tries to make peace with the Pope and says, would it be possible for us to once more have a meeting of the minds? There, by this time, have become two Catholic churches, which there are still today. Could we kind of join forces, and that way maybe you could help me with your armies and your monies so that I can withstand the invading hordes? And the Pope said no, but there's this guy up north in Florence, and he might be able to help you out. I mean, if it's just money, I don't want any of your theological association, but if you're looking for money, there's this guy up north in the city of Florence. And so Emperor Palaiologos goes to Florence with his whole retinue. Now, his court is very much like an Oriental court. I'll show you some evidence of that in just a minute. Byzantine courts are the dress, the people who are assisting the emperor in his particular business. He had astrologers, astronomers, mathematicians. He got mathematicians from North Africa, astronomers from Spain. He got cryptographers and also writing experts from England, and all over the place into his court, and he had a little court school going there. Well, he couldn't get a cent out of the Florentine people, but he made such an impact on Florence, on the whole city, with his court, that the high local mogul of Florence decided to establish an arrangement in Florence very much like the Byzantine court. That high local mogul happened to be Lorenzo de' Medici. And Lorenzo de' Medici's establishment winds up to become the Neoplatonic school and the school of Neoplatonism, with all of its little courses in the humanities, is a copy of Byzantium. Well, that gives you an idea of how long it took for the Byzantine Empire to poop out. Because this we're talking about now is the 14th century. So it lasted a tremendously long time. And actually, our educational system began and greatly influenced by the Neoplatonic school of Lorenzo de' Medici, had its impetus in Byzantium, which is an Oriental thing. Now that's rather mind-expanding. And what's even more mind-expanding is that the average university could care less about Byzantium altogether. I cannot think of an undergraduate program that really deals with anything like adequate information on this particular segment of history, which was very, very important to us. The Gothic Age lasted a quarter of the length of the Byzantine Empire. So I don't know why that is, except I think maybe I can give you a few clues, just maybe a hint or two. And I think that essentially the basic reason is that East is East and West is West. And there are things going on over on that other side that we not only don't identify with, we just assume not. And when we get to a little discussion of the icon, I'll show you how that operates. Okay, the Hagia Sophia, an incredible monument, fantastic. It took the donated income of 300 Byzantine estates annually. A Byzantine estate is comparable to the King Ranch, okay? It took the income of 300 of those, which was contributed annually to the emperor, to pay for the maintenance of the Hagia Sophia. Not the building of it, the mopping up, the polishing, the cleaning annually. So they didn't mess around. How did they get all that? Well, here's a thing we're going to have a hard time understanding if you're interested in it and want a very capsulated and dramatic view of Byzantium. Read Marcel Gourdin's little tiny paperback book called Byzantium, and it's full of all kinds of neat little things that make you wonder why you didn't know more sooner. Constantinople was heaven. I don't mean that they tried to make it like heaven. I don't mean that people really enjoy going there on summer vacations. I mean it was heaven. And the emperor was the personification of Christ. Now you got to simply take my word for this, but that's the way it was. That's actually the way it was. We'll see depictions of the emperor that point this out. Now, when you read the history of Byzantium, it makes you wonder how they managed that, because there were a lot of emperors. In fact, there were even a couple of empresses, and I don't know who she was the personification of. I don't know how that works. I really don't. It takes a kind of an oriental thing cooking there, and I don't know. Besides that, some of the emperors were not what you would call images of Christian virtue. And in fact, a couple of the ladies were even worse than a couple guys. I mean, when it came to emperoring, some of the gals could do pretty well. One of them wiped out her husband because he was going to be heir to the throne. And then she put her three kids in burlap bags and threw them in the river. And then knocked off all the kinfolk as well, except for one who she just blinded. And that was her mistake, because Byzantium wound up with a blind emperor for a couple of years. These guys evidently knew how to work in the dark. He got rid of her, and he didn't have any eyes. A very mysterious thing. This symbol business, the transference thing, and the most important aspect of it, where it happens, is in the icon. Okay, let's look at just a bit more of Byzantium. Mosaic. Mosaic from the Hagia Sophia. Okay? And while somebody brought up a question afterwards last time, not to me, but to my wife. I sort of resent that, folks. If you got a question, she's a physical therapist, and I get these questions secondhand, and I got a hunch that by the time I get a question or answered to her and back to the first party, we may have caused more questions to happen than answers. But if you got a problem, ask me. I probably will have to look it up, but I'd probably learn a lot by looking up the answer. The mosaic, the building started rather early, but the mosaics didn't come until later in the Hagia Sophia, around the 8th and 9th century. Some of the ceiling mosaics are 10th and 11th century, but this is an early one, around 8th century. And check the Oriental influence. First of all, the almond eyes. We've got a facial expression that is almost identical to the one on that little Monza vial. You remember? It's almost exactly the same face. Check also one sure clue of the Oriental influence, and that's the book. The Oriental artist sees man as the beginning of things, and from him everything opens up. And so perspective to the Oriental is, according to the Western mind, reverse. It is not the train track that comes to a point on the horizon line, it's everything opening up and getting bigger and bigger. So here is a very definite Oriental style. And everything in blue and gold. There's only one other color that could possibly have been more expensive than blue, which was cobalt, and gold, which was gold, and that would have been a touch of red. They had a particular crimson red, which was made from mercury, and mercury is more expensive than both of those things. And we'll see an awful lot of mercury glass over in Ravenna. And here we are. There's another garage, or a railroad station, on the outskirts of the town of Ravenna. Ravenna is about 35 miles south of Venice. It was a seaport town at one time, and that's why it became a Byzantine port. It was the western outpost of Byzantium in Italy. The problem with the seaport is that the water went away and Ravenna wound up on high ground and got surrounded by malarial swamps, as did Venice. And it was a natural fortification, but as a seaport, it was a bummer. And so the Byzantine folks had to go elsewhere to send their ships, and they wound up taking them down to Sicily. Okay, but while Justinian was reigning, we have the seaport at Ravenna, and Justinian set up a little Hagia Sophia in Ravenna. I don't know how many of you have been there, but I'll bet you as many people have been to Italy and skipped Ravenna as have been there and seen it. Ravenna is on the way to Venice. And by the time you get to Venice, going up from the south, you're pretty dog tired, and Ravenna looks kind of dismal, at least on the outside. On the inside, Ravenna is like no other city in the world. It has more Byzantine mosaics than any city, including Athens, including Constantinople. And they are handy, and they are just incredible. Ravenna has one particular building. Well, of course, about 6 miles down the road from Ravenna was the little town of Classa. And that's where we had our little basilica that we saw yesterday, San Apollinare in Classa. So this town is just absolutely loaded with goodies. And the goodiest of all of the goodies is this one, San Vitale. San Vitale is a little Hagia Sophia, except that its main tour de force is not its architecture, it is not its dome, it is its mosaics. There is no way, absolutely no way, that anybody can show you a picture of San Vitale and tell you what it's like. The University of Indiana in Bloomington has a two-semester course offering 6 credits at the graduate level in the mosaic cycle of San Vitale, of just this one building. And one of the professors there did his doctoral dissertation on the thing, which is 1,700 pages long, with no illustrations. The guy had no soul. All right. You recall the Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ in Constantinople, half Asian, half European. Same time, same faith, but in another part of the globe, and we wind up with another Jesus altogether. Check him out. We're back to the Apollo. It's in Italy again, and the Italian influence is just simply too strong to say, you know, the Christ of Byzantium is an Oriental Christ. This isn't true. And you'll find it throughout the whole history. Gothic art is northern, you see. Greek art is southern. Constantinople had its solutions to Byzantium, and Italy had its solution. But every square inch of the interior of this building is covered with 1/2 inch by 1/2 inch by 1/2 inch cubes of hand-blown, hand-cut glass. The variety of color in here, the palette range. In other words, if you took each separate color out and made a range of colors that they had available to them, it is 3,040 different colors that they used in the mosaic cycle. An awful lot of gold, but what they used here, that they didn't use over in Constantinople, was this red trim, which you'll find all over the place, and that is that mercury-induced red, and it is worth its weight in platinum. And once again, you measure the amount of this work, this mosaic work, in the San Vitale by the square acre. This is in the apse over the altar. There it is. Up there. The altar is down here with the seat of the bishop. Mosaic cycles over everything. What isn't covered by mosaic is either alabaster or porphyry, which is a rare marble type of stuff. The building just absolutely dissolves under the light from the mosaic. Here is the man. This is Justinian in the center. Check him out. He's got a halo. He's got a halo outlined in red. He's living. In fact, he was there at the dedication service. There he is up on the wall with a halo outlined in red. One of the soldiers is carrying his shield, on which is the chrisma, which is the Cairo. And if you're really interested in detectivizing these little clues to his divinity, check the number of guys in his retinue, and you will find that they are 12.
Where are you?
I'm not sure. Where are you? I guess I didn't understand the question. That's a very strange question. The lady on the other side of this mosaic is the Empress. She also has a halo. Now that is really pushing a point. This is Theodora. I don't know how many of you know about Theodora. They've had books written about her, but she was, for true, in her early days, a prostitute and a bear trainer. Now, that particular combination stood her in very good stead in later life, because while her husband Justinian was writing the first law books for any kind of government, those are still being referred to today, she was in the business of trying to keep the empire intact. And it is my understanding that both of her previous experiences came in handy in order to do that. An incredible woman. And she had a circus, and the emperor was empowered because of his divinity, naturally, to make absolutely anyone in the kingdom empress. And thus, actually, anyone in the kingdom could be emperor, could come from any kind of background. And this happened quite frequently. Check for now the headdress. And I think you'll find a similarity between this and an awful lot of things you have come to imagine as being Japanese headdresses with the little things sticking and the danglies hanging down and so forth. Most of the circles that you see there in that mosaic are sliced pearl. And this particular slide is about twice life size. So there are some fairly good sized pearls sliced up and stuck into this wall. That's the ceiling. That's the ceiling. It's all mosaic. It's the adoration of the Lamb. It's all glass. The process of doing this is to, it is not just to wet the wall with cement and stick little cubes in. What they did was made a big design and then put the cubes on backwards. They'd put them on backwards on paper. They just glue them on with a water-soluble kind of glue. And the paper would be about in sections 2 feet by 2 feet. And then they'd plaster an area, wait for it to almost set, and then they'd take the sheet of paper and just slap it up in there and wait for that to harden around the cubes of glass. After it had set, then you pull off the paper and pray, you know, that the whole thing doesn't come out, which it obviously didn't. This thing was built around 567. and you just don't build like that anymore. Let's look at just a few other outposts of Byzantium to show you the kind of stuff that they were doing. This is the monastery of Hosius Lupus, St. Luke, which is north and a little east, a little west of Athens. Greece also had a lot of Byzantium outposts in it. And the interior of this little church is also covered with some of the most important mosaic cycles in Byzantine history, particularly this lady, surrounded by gold. In the apse, here's one you may be more familiar with. Although, when you look at it, it is such a mishmash of style. It's also in reverse. I managed to move the campanile to the other side of the courtyard. But I think you get the general idea. There's Gothic, there's Renaissance. They've been working on this particular building since about the year 800. The mosaics, even, have been going on since then. They're still working on it. And the interior of this is also of St. Mark's in Venice. It's also covered with very, very fine mosaics. The earlier they are, the better. The Renaissance didn't understand mosaics for nothing. They really messed up the whole thing is gold. I mean, you know, just absolutely everything. A little side altar that has a beautiful icon in it, which I'll show you in just a minute, but everything else is black granite, porphyry, and very rare marble. How's about this? A Byzantine church, and they had a stick of Gothic stained glass window in the side of it. This is St. Mark's in Venice. These Gothic folks, you know, they just couldn't let well enough alone. They still can't. And it overlooks an alley, so there's no way that light can come through it, which I guess it's a good thing. I can't imagine light coming through a Gothic stained glass window shining onto Byzantine mosaic. The cultural shock, I think, would be something. Another view of a similar situation with Christ on the throne of judgment, the Pantocrator, over the apse. And down here is the Palla d'Oro, the veil of gold, which is one of the largest and rarest and most precious icons in the world.
What do these fantastic museums have to do with the church?
This church.
Yes, I understand, but it is a building. Was there also a church?
Oh, yeah. There was a congregation. It was a worshiping congregation, a bishop, the whole schmear, yeah. Yeah, here, not in the Hagia Sophia. The Hagia Sophia has become a museum because the Turks turned it into a mosque, and the Turkish government wasn't allowing it to be turned back into a church, but they didn't feel that it served any purpose as a mosque any longer, so they have turned it into a museum. So there is no congregation for the Hagia Sophia. But there is and was right from the start a very important congregation for San Marco. This is the church where St. Mark is buried, and the congregation was very wealthy. For those of you that are informed about the history of the doges of Venice, Venice was the place that supplied almost all of the raw materials and goods for the Crusaders when they left for the Holy Land, and they made a good business out of it. And so Venice thrived and flourished, and a lot of their income and resources went into the building of this church.
How was the lighting done in these?
Very poorly. This is a very dark and dismal church, and the smoke doesn't help it any. There's a lot of incense and ritual that adds to that. The walls, because you have domes, because we've got five major domes in this place, the walls to support those things have to be very, very heavy. The thrust of a dome is always out, never down. And so there's a tremendous amount of buttressing along the outside. And the more buttressing you have, of course, the less light. So the inside of this is lit primarily by candle. And that adds to the mystery. I mean, really, because the gold mosaic is set into the wall not flat, but at angles. And candlelight is reflected by as many different pieces of glass as you have in the wall. So it's a very, very strange effect, and it is impossible to duplicate it by any other means than this. The pulpit. That's kind of bleh, as pulpits go, and I just show you, I show it to you to show you how much they have, not how neat it all was. That's the major dome, which is the Dome of Pentecost. All gold. And that is the high altar. That is an 11-ton solid piece of black granite, the ciborium, that sets down on four pillars that contain on them probably the best example we have still in existence of early Christian sculpture, a life cycle of Christ and the apostles. Now, over the years, obviously, things have been added to this which have nothing to do with Byzantium. The little statuary and the gewgaws floating around are from later years. And St. Mark was in there, in the altar, according to pious tradition. Well, if you've got evidence to the contrary, I'll listen to it, but they've got an awful lot of evidence that supports it. This is the center little panel of the Pala d'Oro, the veil of gold, which is on the high altar. It faces the other way, and it turns around for high feast day. This is cloisonné. It's enamelware. It is gold leaf laid on so thickly that it can be carved. You have a few of the world's most precious gems in there, and some of the biggest examples of them. There is an amethyst over the halo. It's a little warped by the stream, which is one of the largest amethysts in the world. You've got rubies, pearls, baroque pearls, mashed pearls, the whole schmear. It's
in there.
This particular piece is about that large. And the entire piece is about twice the width of the screen and about the same height. And this one sits in the center. It's surrounded by apostles and angels and saints and martyrs and around and around. It's enormous. Someone figured if you melted the whole thing down and took all the little goodies to the hawk shop, you could wind up with 30 million.
Any significance to the fact he's looking to the right?
Yeah. His head isn't there, but his eyes are. It's towards his hand. His hand is in three. It is in three dimension. It comes projected off of the flat surface in a very strange kind of way, and it is solid gold. And if I could think of a reason right offhand, it would be to explain, which was a very important thing for Byzantine artists in painting the Pantocrator, the two natures of Christ on the throne of judgment, that of severeness, namely good judge, but also mercy. He always has his hand raised in blessing. And some of these Pantocrators, particularly the ones down in Sicily, at Cefalù, for example, the one in the apse, is so severe. He looks like a high lord executioner. And you're desperately looking for that hand, you know. Where's the blessing? Come on, you know, it's got to be around here somewhere. And sure enough, his eyes are looking towards his hand, which is blessing. And that very well may explain the direction here too. Another neat thing that happens in Byzantium, at least for historical purposes, is that they had a terrible controversy. It was called the iconoclastic controversy. And this was over the use of figures. Was it right to portray Christ, for example, and the saints, but particularly Christ, in an image? The Jews, of course, had a law against it, although they broke the law more often than not. We have as many examples of very old synagogues in which they used images as we do in which there were none at all. But there was a fear by the conservative right wing of the Byzantine church that these figures would result in idolatry and that people would be praying to the figure itself and not to the saint that it represented. They had that controversy there in spite of the very oriental nature of images. And as a result, the image makers had to flee. The iconoclasts, the icon smashers, won the day, and for a whole period in Byzantine history, they had to do without images. All those image makers were accused of heresy, and they had to flee to secret places. Here is one of those secret places, the Valley of Goreme, southeast of Ankara in Turkey. Is a valley that looks very much like the moon, with strange projections coming up from the valley floor. And the people lived in the valley and built churches, carved them out of living rock inside these strange forms. There are actually 365 churches in the Valley of Goreme, one for each day. And these churches were not just carved. Some of them are very inaccessible, but some of them were painted with angel processions and things, all stuck right in there into the living rock. Most of them have been defaced by gypsies and Americans. Not necessarily in that order. But there still are some very strange and interesting places. The carving, for example, the very sensitive way in which they would treat a doorway, really beautiful. Another interesting place where they went was this place on the northern edge of the plain of Thessaly in Greece, called Meteora. Meteora is right outside the town down in the valley of Kalambaka, and it is once again a place where these strange tall outcroppings come, these geological things that are caused by erosion, but instead of building into these outcroppings, they built on top of them. See? Up there? Monasteries. Early in their construction, they lived in caves and then built these over a period of years, accessible only by being raised and lowered in a basket along the outside of the wall. It's interesting and it's important. These guys wound up coming under a bunch of strange influences from the outside. Christianity became a state religion in quite a number of places. And the influx of officialdom, of civilization, as it were, of political influence on the doings of church business got some guys just so ticked off that they had to go somewhere else. And they became hermits. I think of a guy like Simon Stylites, who I think must have had some emotional difficulties. He spent 35 years on top of a pillar and just sat there while the faithful congregated below and threw him food, and he preached to them in the wilderness. And we say, boy, if ever the church was in action, this wasn't it. I mean, the running away into the wilderness business. But what happens out of this kind of asceticism, this hiding out and quiet retreating, comes the monastery system. And it is the monastic system that is responsible for the survival of Christendom. A little bit after this. You see, when Christendom moves its headquarters to the east, there's a lot of powerless people left back in Europe, without physical, without military, and without monetary resources. And the thing that saves Christianity under those ages, which we have come to call the Dark Ages, is actually the advent and birthing of the monastic system, which has its origin in places like this. How about that? There's the little curved door, is the one where they threw out the basket with the monk in, or the bread, or whatever it is they needed.
How many would live in a place like that?
Well, every now and then I think it looks pretty good to me.
How many?
Gosh, at one time there were 27, I think. Isn't that right, Liz? In an awful lot of them. And each one of them housed, I'd say in one of these you could have 100 monks. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I don't think they wanted any news. They were afraid of it. It's kind of interesting, when the people came in to try and get them down, when the Turks invaded, they tried to get them down, and they tried to starve them out and do everything they could, and nothing worked until they said they were going to blow the place up. They stuck dynamite down below, and finally the guys came out. And that was the end of Gourmet as a monastic center, except gradually they began filtering back, and today there still are people who live up there, and in fact one of these places is exclusively for women. And it's a lovely place. It is very lovely. To visit. Live there. And inside, it's not bad. The guys are keeping up the old traditions. In the early times, they came and they painted, and over the years, they've continued to keep touching up their paintings. And this, to me, is one of the most exciting Byzantine paintings of all, and this is in the Varlam Monastery at Meteora. And what's really neat to me is that instead of gold, the guy used black. Of all the colors available, you'd think he would have picked something else, but he picked black, and the black really makes this thing rich. I think it's a really beautiful thing. Now, here's an icon. And I don't want to spend a lot of time, because the longer I spend on this, the deeper I get in trouble. I'm way over my depth, and I've spent a fair amount of time talking with people who have made a study of this. Let me just say that this is not a picture of the Virgin Mary. This is the Virgin Mary. It is. It is the essence of her. If it were Christ, it would be the essence of Christ. It would be everything that Christ is. There is no way that you can portray a spiritual reality by depicting a physical likeness. And so what we are actually looking at is depiction of soul. the reality of both body and soul together. Now all of this other stuff like jewels and things comes after the fact of the image. Icon means image. For when Mary, through her son, granted a particular request in order to honor the Virgin, they would stick a stone in or hang a necklace around her neck. And the accumulation of things over a period of time makes this thing really a hunk of stuff, which is all in addition to that very essential element of this actual being, of the person it personifies, or of the person it depicts. There is no way that we can identify with this except perhaps work. I don't know where you get your bread, but in the Missouri Synod, most of us get our wafers for the Eucharist from the America's largest fish food factory. It rankles me a bit, but I got a hunch. These are fish food wafers that we have at the Lord's table, and it does sort of take some of the mystery out of it. But all right, we send away for little wafers from a factory, and we go down to the store and we get our manischewitz or whatever it is we get. We put it together as faithful people and agree, not that it looks like, not that it tastes like, not that it represents or stands for, but this is my body. This is my blood. How do we get away with doing that to fish food and manischewitz? How do we? Now, there may be a mystery that most of us are not willing enough to get into deep enough, because we say, well, where intelligence lets off, faith begins, which is a real cop-out, folks. It's a real cop-out. It's a good reason for remaining faithful, but dumb. And I don't like that. But I think that with the Eucharist, we can see the relationship between physical and spiritual. And now if you stop to realize that in Byzantium, all of the icon makers are priests, and that the making of an icon is a sacred act, and that that style and making of icons is handed down from father to son, I would like to remind you that in the Greek Orthodox Church, the priest can marry. It is a sacrament, the making of the icon. And this is Mary. That's hard. That is really hard. And it takes a kind of an Oriental approach to the incarnation. Word made flesh. Back and forth kind of thing, the thing that Carol did so beautifully this morning. Physical stuff, but it's all tied up with spiritual reality.
What size was that?
About like so.
Was that the Jesus, the baby in the center of it?
Yeah. Yeah, the baby. Now sometimes, once again, the Mary figure too is a real rough thing to come by, because here she's not even holding it. She hasn't got any arm. And sometimes she looks like she wished she wasn't. Like she's holding it out like that, like it just had an accident or something. Or she'll sit it on her tummy and just look straight ahead. Like so. As though there's almost no maternal relationship between mother and child at all. Once again, it's that combination of justice and blessing. And the same attitude that is used for the depiction of Christ comes out in the depiction of Mary. One wants to laugh a little bit, like all Byzantine baby Jesuses look like 30-year-old midgets. And we say, boy, did they have trouble painting babies. They could care less about painting babies. They were painting the spirit of Christ. That is the Christ child. And no Christian understands the Christ child without understanding the context of death, resurrection, as well as of birth. So it's the soul of Christ. I gotta quit so we can go see Al Pitcher. Okay? Thank you.